Colleagues, welcome back to the office. Welcome to our podcast for today. Today's podcast is going to be looking at choosing the right technology provider for your organization, part two. We're actually off this week, so this is a recording from a recent State Society conference, which I thought you might enjoy. And in this series, what we have been looking at are the questions that you really want to ask yourself regarding, you know, choosing your providers. You know, who's going to be your host? Who's going to be your managed service provider? What type of utility and are they going to be providing? And what kind of questions should we be asking ourselves with respect to the different services that they are going to offer? Most organizations are subject matter experts with respect to the, you know, accounting or finance or insurance or something like that. But, you know, frankly, we aren't all tech experts and we have to, you know, lean on other people to be able to provide these services to our organizations. Finding the right people will make all the difference for your organization. It's the difference between having reliability, stability, security, and redundancy, or just hoping and praying for the best to occur inside your organization. So we, in the second half of this class, we're going to be looking at things around security, redundancy, and compliance. We're going to be looking at some of the big questions that we should be asking ourselves and asking these providers on how we can provide these key features to our organizations. We'll talk about policies, procedures, and processes, things around device and workstation management, the questions that we want to ask around how to set this up for scalability for future growth inside the company. We'll talk about some of the best practices around remote access, as well as communication to and from your staff that might be working remotely. In today's environment, with most folks, for example, working at home or working from, you know, maybe an RV or from a work share place during COVID-19, having good remote access and having good communication set up inside your organization is an absolute essential. We'll finish with just a couple of best practices regarding backup that we should at least be familiar with and concerned with for our organization. Now, before we get started today, I do want to remind you that today's podcast is eligible for CPE credit. If you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, you can earn a CPE credit for watching or listening to today's podcast. It's super simple. After watching or listening, head on over to cpetoday.com and use course code SRT2. And you will earn a credit for today's class. You take a quick 5-question quiz and you will get a PDF certificate that you can print off for your records, and you will be well on your way for maintaining compliance for your organization. Okay, so I will join you back at the end of our podcast today. At the end, and we'll go ahead and wrap up with a couple of review questions, and then we'll go ahead and get you on your way. So I hope you'll enjoy the second half of our presentation on how to select the right technology provider for your company. Thanks, and I'll see you at the end. Security, redundancy, and compliance. Okay, so here's some questions you should be thinking about as you work with different providers. Okay. When was the last time your team or a contractor of yours scanned our network to check with vulnerabilities? Okay. When I look at a provider, I want to know what their security policies are. You know, what are the update policies? What are their network policies? Who can interact with our data? Who can get on our network and stuff like that? And I like it not only at the beginning of the contract, but throughout the contract. And I feel like they should be doing this regularly. They should be scanning the network and they should be looking for vulnerabilities. And they should be proactively looking for things to improve and change. They should not be waiting on Steve Yeah saying, hey, I noticed there's my computer's running really slow and there's a whole bunch of weird foreign characters, you know, and the screen telling me that I need to send them Bitcoin for there to be a problem. They should be proactively monitoring this stuff and finding resolution, finding different ways to improve it, you know? So often when you get on board with a new contractor, a new provider, you know, they're going to jump to and they're going to give you their attention. I don't care about the attention right in the beginning. I know I'll get that no matter what. I want to know I'm going to get your attention a month from now, 2 months from now. I want to know that you are going to be as committed to this relationship at contract execution as you are a year into this, because I want a provider for the long term. So I should tell you that you should be asking them, what type of software are they using to look at your network? What did they find? Was anything unusual discovered? If so, how was it resolved? And if you did find, like, for example, unapproved devices, what were they? How did they get there? And what can we do to prevent that from occurring again? Okay. Do you have any sort of third-party penetration testing? Okay, this is sometimes referred to as pen testing. Okay, penetration testing. Financial institutions, for example, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they're required to go through this usually on a quarterly basis. They have to have a penetration firm that will attempt to compromise the organization and be able to get in and exfiltrate data. You know, this is a really, really good option if you're looking to put rubber to the road and understand essentially where your risks might be. With penetration testing, what we are doing essentially is that we are testing to see if there is a problem. And if there is a problem, can we resolve it? And rarely should the penetration testing folks also be your IT people. It should be somebody independent that doesn't have a vested interest in maintaining that contract. The penetration testing people, if they do find something, will tell you about it. And then the IT people should resolve it. And then it should be tested again. So penetration testers should not be tasked with fixing the vulnerabilities that they find, you know, and it's the same with software development. If you designed it, you built it, you can't really quality test it or QAQC your own work. You're just too close to it. And you're not going to find the actual risks and issues there. Okay, what is your procedure for installing updates and patches on our network and workstations? Okay, data needs to be updated regularly and systems need to be updated regularly, whether it is a, you know, a computer, whether it is a server, whether it is a network appliance or something like that. You know, your computer and those devices themselves should be updated on a fairly regular basis. And by fairly regular, they should be checking and applying critical security updates autonomously and automatically. There should be, it shouldn't require in most instances a IT person to update that device itself. It should essentially just occur automatically. Now, that's not the same for feature updates. You know, there's, for example, going to be feature updates that will occur where they bring new stuff to the computer. And that's fine. You know, you could choose when to update those features. But when security updates are released, they should be applied the second they are released. Because so many, and I mean, if you did one security best practice, if you only did one thing, and you hopefully should do more than one thing, but if you only did one thing, it should be to keep your devices up to date. That is my absolute best recommendation when it comes to keeping your devices secure. Keep them up to date. If we look at malware, ransomware, all the nasty stuff that could occur, almost exclusively, it occurs when people are using out-of-date and older tech. Okay, so keep those devices up to date. That is probably the overall best thing you could do. Now, with respect to this, you know, you should be doing a lot more than that. But, you know, if you only did one thing, that would be that one thing that I would recommend. So, and you could certainly do a lot of testing to ensure that this actually is working the way that you think it will be. Now, you should also be looking at some of the network appliances, firewall, routers, unified threat management. Infiltration. Like an infiltration alert system. Oh my, there's a term for this and I can't think of it off the top of my head. But essentially there are devices that will tell you if a unauthorized device, unauthorized service essentially has compromised your computer's network, your home network or your office network and let you know when that is and what you could do to essentially resolve it. Okay, well, is that provider, you know, taking care of that for you? Do they have a strategy, for example, for keeping these devices up to date and monitoring it, both for the connections authorized and the attempts, hopefully attempts for unauthorized access as well? You know, what type of device is there? What is it, a hardware device? Is it a software device? Are you qualified to work on this? A good example of this is Cisco gear. You know, Cisco, one of the largest technology companies in the world. You know, they make switches, routers, phones, lots of stuff like that. I will tell you, it's very complicated to work with, really complicated stuff. And I don't touch it. It's way outside of my area of expertise. But, you know, if I were to get those things inside of our organization, I would want to ensure that it is properly set up and configured. So you might want to ask, for example, what certifications do you hold? If you're working with Amazon Web Services, you know, hey, have you gone through the AWS training? And how up to date are you with the AWS training? AWS, Azure, you know, they have a lot of different certification that you can choose to get that will essentially, you know, tell you what level of competency that somebody has, and you can get certified in a lot of different areas for a lot of different things. And it's very similar. Let me just go ahead and show you this over here to a lot of the industry certifications that we will see. Okay. So here's the AWS certification page, and they've got a ton of different levels. They've got associate levels, which are kind of like your introductory thing, as well as the professional levels, which we'll talk about, you know, essentially on the more professional side of this, on the more expert side of this, what to expect, you know. So they've got stuff, for example, on the more professional side, which are going to be more your business stuff, you know, how do you leverage AWS tech, for example, to build business solutions. And then they've definitely got, for example, more on the engineering side of this, you know, for example, around building solutions and what they might be. And then they've also got different specialties for databases, even up to machine learning and others. But these different paths are very similar to, like, for example, the CPA exam. They'll have a number of conditional requirements in order to be able to get certified. And then ultimately you would need to schedule an exam to prove competency in a particular area. And they offer updates to these regularly in terms of, you know, as they come out with different products and services, so that, you know, somebody who took, for example, an AWS exam in 2010, I mean, and that's all they did, I mean, that's not really relevant anymore. I mean, there's a lot more going on, and they should ideally be staying up on with this on a regular basis. Okay. Someone writes in, am I thinking of intrusion detection? Yes, that absolutely is what I was thinking of. I'm going to give you a bell there as well. So thank you so much. That was the word I couldn't think of, was intrusion detection. And those are applications that, and hardware appliances that will essentially help you detect when your network has been otherwise compromised. Now, other major security appliances that you should be considering for your network, whether they be cloud network or your office network, basic stuff, routers, firewalls, switches, servers, storage area networks, network area store, network level storage as well, backup, all these things should be considered. You might need them, you might not need them, but if you choose to get these, and you might very well need them, make sure that they're up to date, you know, make sure that they're running the latest security software and that they are reasonably tied down and reasonably secured to the best of your abilities. And whenever possible, do not expose them publicly to the internet, meaning do not make them so that they can be accessible to people outside of that network. I should not be able to, for example, view your network router or view your network backup appliance from the public-based internet. That's a really bad security practice. And often we'll see this not necessarily with those devices, but other stuff like printers and, you know, video cameras and telephone systems. They just won't be set up correctly, and they'll be publicly available on the internet where other people can find them and potentially compromise them. I'm going to show you just a really quick resource, which is really useful for kind of illustrating what I'm talking about here. There is a website. It's one of my favorite to demonstrate. It's called Shodan, and that's Shodan.io. And Shodan is a search engine for connected devices. Okay, we have lots of different types of search engines. We got search engines for people. What are they? Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Okay, we got search engines for knowledge, which would be Google or Bing. You know, we've got search engines that do all different types of things. Well, Shodan is a search engine for connected devices on the internet, okay? And it's specifically scanning the internet to find, for example, data and devices that are exposed, everything from refrigerators to power plants to telephone systems to, you know, Internet of Things devices, you know, or the Internet of Insecure Things in a lot of ways as well. And you could put in your IP address in here. You could put in a specific company name in here. You could put in a lot of different things inside of here. And you could essentially try to go and find those different devices. You know, if I type in Cisco, for example, it will give me a list of different Cisco devices that are publicly accessible on the internet. Well, if I know, for example, what type of device that is, and I know what version of the Cisco iOS operating system it is, I might be able to penetrate that particular item. So if I just search, for example, Cisco devices, there are 4.8 million Cisco devices listed on the internet. If we look over here in the United States, we can see there's a, we'll go back. I need to log in to see further details here. But we can see there's about 500,000 devices just here in the U.S., okay? And from here, I can essentially figure out what type of device this is and where that device is located potentially. And if there's something really old about this device, because typically these devices advertise what type of device they are, I could potentially compromise that device, you know? And so that's something that we should be considering. And this is a device, a website that you can use to check your organization's IP, your organization's name, and it will tell you if you've got anything publicly accessible to the internet. It will essentially help you keep track of what you've got connected to the internet and what the internet can see about you. In my mind, this is one of the best tools that you can use on a regular basis to monitor your organization's security for really kind of low-hanging, easy stuff. I mean, this is going to get all the basic stuff. It's not going to get a lot of the really complicated stuff, but it will get the stuff that is publicly available. And often, if we think about, for example, with attackers and hackers, it's all about numbers. You know, it is, they're all thinking about, you know, hey, can I access this device easily and compromise? And if not, if you just make it that much difficult, they just move on to the next one because it's not in their interest, to consider, hacking your organization specifically. Now, if you're a Microsoft or a Dell or you're a big company or you're a celebrity for that matter, yeah, you probably have a higher risk, but for the most of us, as long as you're not low-hanging fruit, it's going to reduce your risk pretty considerably. Okay, you should be asking, how do you manage passwords for network-attached devices? You know, and how do people get into these particular devices? If you are interested, later today, I will be doing a K2 class on password management tools, how and where to use them, and I will be talking about in depth best practices with respect to managing passwords and some of the major tools that are out there. I'm going to give you a quick hint. The answer is use a password management tool such as RoboForm, LastPass, KeePass, or something like that. It'll save you a lot of time. But we'll talk through why those tools work and why they are effective. Are you using remote network monitoring software on the network? You can't see it, okay? But I will tell you, I have a monitor up here in my office, it's a big flat screen TV that gives me in real time the status of every single client and their network and the infrastructure that we have in place that we're monitoring for them. And there are probably about 40 up there that I'm looking at real time, and I get an alert on that screen. My partner and we also have a few of our staff as well can see those items as well. And that's really helpful because it lets us know if there is an issue, what we need to do to essentially resolve it. And, you know, we could proactively take care of it before the client calls us, you know, before there is an issue. Let me go ahead and show you another really kind of really useful service that's free as well. It's one of my absolute favorites. It's called Uptime Robot. Uptime Robot is a fantastic server monitoring tool. It basically pings a website or a service every couple of minutes. If you have the paid plan, which is absolutely worth it, it will ping every minute, basically, and it will tell you, hey, am I alive? Am I alive? Is there a problem? And if there is a problem, you could set different resolution. So for us, for example, if a server goes offline, it sends an email to our network team. It also sends a message on our Microsoft Teams account. We can see it and we can resolve that particular issue. And we can also, for example, set up status pages. So here's an example for one of our companies here where they could essentially look and they can see the status over a period of time, you know, if there's any issues with these different systems that they have in place here. And so we could see that at the moment, all systems are operational. The last time there was some downtime was 2 weeks ago, and that's when we ran a server update for a brief moment here to update a specific server. Okay, but we could see, for example, what the status is. So we've had 100% uptime over the last, in this particular case, 7 days, and 99.9999% update over the last month. And if there's any sort of issues, this site will proactively tell us where those issues are and we can choose to resolve them. Other best practices, antivirus, anti-malware, you know, enforced antivirus, enforced anti-malware can be very, very helpful and effective. And I would definitely be talking to my provider about what anti-malware solution that they are using to secure our network as well as our infrastructure and what they're using internally. Unfortunately, there's been plenty of examples of organizations having a data breach occur, not due to any fault of their own, but because the service provider had a problem. They got compromised, which in turn caused the client to be compromised. For those of you who attended the conference last year in our current tech crimes ripped from the headlines, a course written by my good friend and co-author Brian Tankersley, he talked about how there was a number of cities in Texas that experienced a data breach because they were using a common IT service provider, and the provider got compromised and then was able to steal credentials to the cities and then compromise those cities. Having anti-malware can be incredibly helpful for reducing that risk. So, what type of anti-malware, antivirus solutions do you deploy? What kind of content and websites are blocked? What kind of filtration do you have in place inside of your organization to ensure that if there is a compromise, we can contain it as much as possible? Let me go ahead and show you two websites real quick with respect to choosing anti-malware. And there's a lot of options that you can consider. So if you're looking just to kind of get a survey, AV Test is probably the best. It's independent and they do these tests monthly. So if we come over here to avtest.org, and that's a dash between AV and test and .org. If we come over here to the test sections, we can go ahead and view, hey, what are the best for home, business, Internet of Things, so on and so forth. Let's go ahead and take a look at our Windows antivirus. Okay. Well, the most regular or the most recent test has been in February of this year. And we can see they do a detailed breakdown and analysis of these different companies and the different products that they have in place. And so we could see, for example, how good are they with respect to protection, performance, usability, so on and so forth. And I would tell you, do your own due diligence and get a sense of essentially what these applications can do. Now, for my money, I like Trend Micro. Okay. Trend Micro is a company that's been in the protection and anti-malware space for a very, very long time. That's what we deploy in our network. That's what we deploy for our clients. I've had very good success with it. I would tell you to take a look at them if you don't have a solution in place already. And I could tell you it's not going to break the bank. I would tell you that you should budget about $50 per user per year. And that seems to be about a good going rate overall. Okay. Another thing that we should be considering would be network segmentation. Okay. For our providers, how do they design the topology of the network? Topology means how these things are organized and where certain things are located. You know, for example, are all my clients running in one network, or do we use what are called VLANs or virtual LANs where they are segmented so that if client one has a breach, will it affect other client two? And are they essentially segmented in such a way that we can reduce our risk? And by physically segmenting these things into separate networks, we significantly lower the risk overall. We could be looking at compliance frameworks. We already touched upon this a little bit, but there are a number of security frameworks that can be really helpful and effective. And depending on what type of organization we are, these might be mandatory. For example, like if we're dealing with medical data, well, guess what? We have to deal with HIPAA. Are we dealing with credit cards? Guess what? We have to deal with PCI compliance. And there's lots of other ones. You know, some of the big ones that have popped up here in the last couple of years, a big, big one is GDPR, General Data Protection Regulations in the European Union. You do anything in the EU now, most likely you're going to have to be subject to GDPR. And you could thank GDPR for all the thousands of notices you've gotten over the last year saying this site uses cookies. Are you okay with that? This, that, or the other. Well, that's required from the GDPR perspective to have in place. Now, with respect to infrastructure of this, we have different type of infrastructure depending on the provider that we're working with. We have tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, and tier 4 infrastructure providers, you know, and this all comes back to redundancy. You know, your tier one providers, for example, will have redundancy with respect to internet and power, you know, but that's really kind of where the story ends. And typically you'll also have good uptime, 99.6% uptime, you know, but it's not going to be perfect. And this is okay for occasional users and companies, for example, you know, that maybe don't live and breathe and live and die based off of the availability of their technology. And typically these will be cheaper. You know, you could expect downtime, though, anywhere from 1 to 2 days a year. At 99.6% uptime translated, you're going to have 1 or 2 days a year that is going to be offline. However, if you work your way up to a tier four provider, which are going to be your big service providers like Amazon or Microsoft, they've got redundancy in every critical system: internet, power, internal power, external power. They'll typically even have contracts with power companies as well as generator companies that can essentially do this. And, you know, in the event of a major outage, can even bring more generators if need be here. And what we could typically expect with this is anywhere from 4 to 6 nines of redundancy, where we can expect less than 20 minutes of downtime in a particular year. And depending on the nature of what you're working with, that might be essential. You know, if you're a Kaiser Permanente or an Aetna or a hospital, and this is data for your electronic medical record system, you betcha you need to have a provider that is going to ensure that their systems work as much as possible. Now, when we look at a tier four provider here, we're looking at redundancy across the board. You know, they're going to have redundancy in all the main things from power, cooling, internet access. They will have multiple redundancies in place. Instead of just a single internet provider, they might have a dozen different internet providers, and they might even have their own networks to other systems. Likewise, they're going to have both what's called UPS backup, which is an unstoppable power supply, which is essentially batteries, as well as diesel generators, and sometimes even multiple diesel generators to support that. So that if any one thing fails, it doesn't result in any interruption of to the client itself. Essentially, the client can keep running and can keep operating. They can keep running all the time. Now, if we look at this, there are a lot of different specifications for what qualifies a tier one and what qualifies a tier one and a tier two and a tier three provider here. You know, so generally, I would tell you you're going to be better off with a tier three and tier four. And frankly, you know, the cost differential between this in 2021 is not massive anymore. You know, I mean, most providers are pretty reasonable these days and will have almost all of this in place. Okay. Let's go ahead and talk about our next section here, which are going to be policies, procedures, and processes. I am a very much a policy guy. I'm also very much a process guy. I'm a systems guy. I love systems. And to me, individual outcome is not as important as the process itself. I'm not an ends justify the means. I'm a means justify the ends. And I like process in organizations. And I think a lot of it comes from my accounting background. So much of what we do in accounting is process oriented. It's the same work typically per period. You know, if we did a balance sheet reconciliation in January, probably can end up doing it in February, March, and so on and so forth. And so putting policy in place brings redundancy. It brings in a sense of security, and it generally, in my opinion, just makes things a little bit more stable, where we can put the same input and expect the same output. And security is no different than this. There are a number of policies that you should consider in place for your organization that can help improve and assist your organization for security and redundancy in its operations. You know, we have, for example, acceptable use policies dictating and discussing how technology should be used inside your organization, whether they be, for example, how we use email, how we do disaster recovery, what is our password policy. And then we can also get really specific as well with network specific policies. You know, hey, in 2020 and 2021, everybody works remote. We should have a standard remote access policy telling our staff what to do and how to do and how they should operate remotely. Because what we don't want to end up with is a vast difference between how security is being applied inside of our organization. What I mean by this is that somebody like Steve, you know, who has a lot of experience and knowledge and knows the bad things that could occur when security is not taken seriously, should be held to the same standard as, you know, Bob, you know, who maybe isn't going to be as concerned about this inside the organization. Because you know what? Steve's not going to be the problem. It's going to be Bob who unfortunately is going to click on something that's going to infect the computer, but then will ultimately affect everybody inside of the organization. You know, we need to have policies that essentially dictate the standards for the organization and hold people to the same standards. Because you know what? Security is one of those things that has to be applied uniformly from the CEO all the way down to the intern. And you cannot trust your staff to make good security decisions. You know, 20 plus years in software development and in technical services, unfortunately, that's really the case, is that, you know, most staff just don't have enough competency. And whether they intentionally do it or not, they're going to end up doing something that could cause a data breach. And if we head it off at the pass, hopefully we can reduce that risk to a more manageable level. So we have all different types of policies: acceptable use, network. We could have server policies for that matter. And you might want to incorporate some of these into your company handbook. So you might want to, for example, actually take the time, write them out, and include them in the company handbook, and then hold people accountable to it. Let me show you a fantastic resource. This is one of the K2 favorites, one of our go-tos with respect to management of policies inside of the organization. And I'm just going to point this out, and you can find the ones that will make sense for your organization. There's this fantastic group. It's called the SANS Institute, and they focus on technology and cybersecurity training for companies. And they've got a ton of great webinars and great resources. Check them out. They're really worth your time and effort. But I got to point out to you one of their really cool resources, and I consider this just to be a public service, which is this free resources option here. So go to SANS.org, go ahead and click these free resources. Okay, you can find a ton of great webcasts, white papers, blogs, newsletters, and others. But what we are really interested in is right over here, the security policy templates. And if we click this, they have gone through the effort of essentially writing a bunch of really good security policies for your organization, you know? So as an example here, let's go look at that remote access policy, and they've got a ton of them. So we are going to go ahead and let me just make this a little bit bigger. All right, and let's go ahead and find that remote access policy. Here we go. And the way this works is that they offer these policies in two forms, in PDF as well as in doc, you know, so a Word file. We're going to leave the doc alone, but just know it's a Word file. And the intention of that would be that you could download it, take the text out, modify it to your specific needs, and off to the races you go. Okay, so here's the SANS Institute remote access policy, and it's got a lot of the stuff that you're just not going to know off the top of your head. Or they've gone through a lot of effort to think about all the different things that you might want. And so we've got the overview here, you know, essentially how remote access works. But the real meat of this is going to be kind of in this section, the policy, you know, and it's a find and replace type thing. So ABC company provides mechanisms for you to be able to collaborate between internal and external folks, you know, this, that, or the other. And it's going to have specific things like, you know, for example, you must, for example, use authentication, like a good, strong password. Authentication has to come through Active Directory, which is a Microsoft technology. Compliance. Hey, anything that's exceptions to this has to be approved in advance by the team. But they've got all these really kind of cool policies, which can be very, very effective for your organization managing your different technology risk. And frankly, most of us, myself included, just don't have the expertise and background and really kind of the vision to think about every single policy that that company might require. So in my opinion, that's a really kind of a no-brainer for what you might want to use. All right, let's talk about our next section here, which is going to be device and workplace management. Okay. Now, a network is just a collection of different devices. Okay. We got laptops, we've got servers, we've got workstations, so on and so forth. We need to manage these things for the updates, the security, the anti-malware, this, that, or the other. You might want to consider, for example, mobile device management specifically for your mobile devices to ensure that when your staff, for example, are, setting up and configuring their phone to accept corporate email or being able to access corporate resources on that, that it is a secured device. And utilizing these different devices now, I mean, a phone has just as much access as a laptop or a tablet generally. And, you know, ensuring that that phone is properly secured is absolutely in the best interest in the organization, you know, because again, I mean, you can cause a data breach with a mobile handset almost as easily as you can cause it with a desktop computer, you know? So for example, ensuring that your staff, if they're going to be using their own devices, like their own computers or their own phones, you want to make sure that those are properly secured and configured. I'm an iPhone user, so let me show you a quick resource from Apple, which can be really effective for this, that you can apply across the company. Okay, this is called Apple Configurator. You can go ahead and search for this. Unfortunately, you have to use a Mac to be able to use this. So I've got a separate computer I've used in the past when I've configured this for staff and I've configured this for clients. But this Apple configuration tool is a free tool from Apple that allows you to be able to configure how these devices should be used inside of your corporate network. And for example, how long a user's PIN or password should be on their iPhone, how frequently they should have to be required to change those PINs or passwords, what devices and what apps can they ultimately end up using. So there's lots of options with respect to this, but this tool is something that you could essentially use to set up and configure your users' iPhone devices. And once you kind of put them out in the field, you could then know, even if it's not somebody you see all the time, that that device is set up and set up correctly. Okay. And it's, again, it's just something you have to do, but it would be a good question to ask the providers you're working with, you know, hey, what kind of configuration are you doing on the mobile side of this as well? So we have a lot of different options with respect to this. That's just one. I can tell you that Symantec also makes a pretty cool tool as well. That's also worth it taking a look at as well. We also have other technologies, for example, data loss prevention or DLP. Okay. DLP is a really cool technology that will help you identify where potential data breaches could occur and can typically almost stop them in process. Okay. DLP essentially scans a network and its data both at rest and in its transit, meaning that, you know, if I've got, for example, a spreadsheet with 1,000 social security numbers or credit card numbers in it, I might want to know if that's getting emailed to somebody, or if a staff member, for example, is sending confidential information out from our organization that could potentially cause a data breach, I might want to know about it. Well, DLP can scan the network, it could scan the devices, attempt to find those files that could potentially be used for data breaches, or the emails or chat messages in Teams or other places like that, and apply security policies to them. In fact, if you are using Office 365, the enterprise version of this, okay, so the E3 and the E5 plans, DLP is baked right into the solution. So you can create your own DLP policies that can apply to the organization and will scan SharePoint, OneDrive, Teams, Exchange, Outlook, and others attempting to find those different problems for you. And you can create different policies depending on your specific risk. You know, so if you're dealing with healthcare data, it can look for PII, personally identifiable information. Or if you're working with credit card data, it can look for credit card numbers or bank account numbers or ACH numbers and stuff of that nature. And if certain conditions apply, it can take certain actions. Like if, you know, somebody's trying to email out a spreadsheet with a bunch of social security numbers in it or a bunch of credit card numbers in it or doing a database extract and downloading the potentially confidential information, well, it could stop it dead in its tracks. And that's what's really kind of cool about that tech. Now, a tech that you should absolutely be using across the board as much as possible is MFA or multi-factor authentication. I would recommend that you check out our passwords course, which will be later today, and I'm going to talk about MFA in depth. But MFA is fantastic for helping to reduce risk for an organization because if a password is stolen, and frankly, it's an inevitability in some particular instance, the users will not be able to have their account compromised unless they also got the other device that provides authentication. MFA uses two methods of security to ensure that a service or platform is secured. A great provider, and this is, in my opinion, one of the things that I really look for, makes this mandatory. I understand there's always this trade-off with security and convenience. Something that's more secure is less convenient. Something that's more convenient is less secure. But certain things should not be optional anymore. And in my opinion, and I'm going to say across the board with most of the other K2 instructors as well, MFA, multi-factor authentication, reduces the risk probably more than any other security technique that you could do, you know. And there are a lot of different MFA tools that are out there. For example, the one I use is LastPass Authenticator, but there's the Microsoft Authenticator, there is the Google Authenticator, and we'll talk more about MFA in this afternoon's presentation. If you're not familiar with that tech, I'll give you a really good rundown of why that might be useful. Now, in terms of computer hardware, there's a lot of flexibility in here. You know, service providers typically will have their own flavor that they are used to. I personally don't have a big major preference, but I will tell you a few of my favorite brands here in a minute. I will tell you that the individual brand, like whether it's HP or Dell, maybe Dell, let's say Dell, just because it's a great Texas company. If you pick Dell, stay with Dell. You know, where I really cannot stand it with companies is when they, again, they're so price conscious that they make it so inconvenient for themselves and they start buying tech from Costco or Best Buy and they end up having a hodgepodge and mismatch of, oh, we got a Samsung printer, we've got an HP laptop, we've got a Dell server, we've got a couple of Apple devices. And you know what? That just frankly makes it a nightmare for IT to manage. I don't care what you buy. Just buy the same of everything. If you got HP printers, buy HP printers for everybody. You know, that makes toner, drivers, compatibility stuff much, much easier to deal with. I would tell you, whatever you choose to end up getting, make sure you get business-grade technology. Business-grade technology is built to a higher standard. It is going to last longer. It's going to be more reliable. And for my money, I mean, reliability is the most important thing that I look at when I'm buying tech. And it's the thing that I want. I need to know this machine is going to work. I need to know it's going to function. Now, I don't have a huge preference on stuff. I will point out these brands always have a pretty good reputation. If I had to put dollars to donuts, I would say that I like HP probably more than Dell just a little bit, mostly just because I've got more experience with it and I've worked with that tech a little bit longer. However, I will point out I absolutely emphatically love Lenovo ThinkPad devices. I've got mine right here. I think these are the absolute best laptops for so many different reasons, and this is the only laptop I buy, and I buy them for all my staff. They are not cheap. You know, this computer is probably $2,500, but I'll tell you what, boy, does it operate? Does it shine? Does it work well? And I will, this is incredibly reliable. It's lightweight. It meets all of my particular specifications and they've got them at different price points. I need a really high-end machine because of the teaching and the webcasting and this, that, and the other, you know what, but we can buy them also, you know, around, I would say about $1,000 too. But I personally think the ThinkPads are fantastic. In terms of networking gear, you know, Dell makes the Sonic Walls, which I really like. I think they work really, really well. I'm a big fan of Brocade devices for network, and I'm also a big fan of Ubiquiti stuff for Wi-Fi. I will tell you, I generally avoid any big box retailer. I don't generally buy the house brands of anything. I like dedicated brands. Generally, I've just found them to work much better for my intention and use. So think about the brands, whatever you end up choosing to get, I would tell you that, you know, generally you're going to be fine. Just try to buy the same of everything. Okay, a couple more things, and we're going to be wrapping up here in about 6-7 minutes or so. Let's spend a few minutes talking about remote access. Okay, now we have a couple of other sessions that are going to be talking about remote access throughout the conference for today. So I'm not going to kill this topic, but I will point out that there are a number of remote access technologies that you should be considering. And in fact, we talked about that in the first part of our section today. You know, do you go with like a Citrix-based approach? Do you go with a Microsoft remote desktop approach? It's really kind of up to you. I will tell you, most often you're going to end up having to have a couple of different solutions. Totally reasonable to have a VPN, virtual private network. You could also be using more sophisticated technologies like SSH, secure SOCKs. You could be using remote desktop technologies such as Microsoft RDS and others. But some questions to consider with your service provider. How are your remote access users validated? How are they configured? How are they set up? Do you lock it down so that they can only operate maybe from their home, or do you have it open to the world? And what kind of authentication device are you using? I will tell you, with remote access, you always want to use two-factor authentication. 2FA is absolutely essential with respect to implementing secure remote access. And in fact, if you don't set it up there, I mean, that's when a lot of folks end up getting into trouble. A technology that's often used is Microsoft Remote. It's Microsoft Remote Desktop Protocol, or RDP. In and of itself, a pretty cool tech, and a lot of folks use it, myself included. But, you know, one of the bad things with respect to remote desktop connections is that most folks don't take the time to lock it down and configure it. If you're going to end up using RDP, okay, make sure you're using a VPN in front of it. Make sure you're using two-factor authentication in front of it. And hopefully that will reduce your risk to a more acceptable level. Okay. Now, if you are going to do this, other things you might want to consider, for example, would be what licenses or services are required to make this work. You know, are there any sort of limitations on performance, scope of service, you know, and if you don't have a lot of experience configuring remote desktop connection, my personal go-to that's easy peasy for getting, for example, to your work computer from home is a service called RealVNC. Okay, and that's realvnc.com. It's free for personal use. You can have up to 5 computers in your account, and it provides really easy, effective remote access for managing your organization. And for me, it works really, really well. This allows me, for example, to get into my parents' computers, other family members as well. And one of the reasons I really like it, not only because it's very affordable, but it supports a wide range of devices. So with RealVNC and their VNC Connect product, I can absolutely get into a Mac from a PC, or into a Linux box, or something else like that. Other comparable solutions, for example, would be TeamViewer. And I like TeamViewer too. I've just used RealVNC a long time, and I like it because it supports a wider range of devices. But TeamViewer is pretty comparable, as well as GoToMyPC and other solutions like it. Okay, so communication. Communication is incredibly important for this. I would tell you that a good service provider will have multiple methods of communication that you can work with. You know, for example, they will have phone support. They might have help desk support. They might have ticket support, email support, something like that. You should be able to reach and communicate out to these people as needed. You know, I will tell you, generally, phone support for me isn't as important as email support. You know, I don't think most of us like talking on the phone anymore either. So I'm mostly interested in finding a provider that I can communicate with on, you know, over email. You know, I want to be able to open a ticket. I want to be able to see that ticket resolved within a reasonable period of time. So for me, that's important. However, if you're more of a phone-centric person, you're definitely going to want to consider a provider that you can call. Certain providers, for example, like Amazon, Microsoft, and others, these big cloud tech companies, they do not offer phone support. So you should know that as a limitation going into it. Services like that generally are intended to be be used by professionals. And when properly set up and configured, they're fine, you know, because I know what I'm looking at. I can resolve 99% of those issues myself. And if there's a bigger issue, more often than not, it's a service outage. But, you know, it's not intended to be used by individuals that don't have that level of expertise. So finding good methods of communication with your provider can be really important and effective. All right, last thing, then we're going to go ahead and wrap up for the day, would be backup. backup should be a two-way street. You know, the provider should be taking a majority of the burden of providing backup, but I will tell you that it is ultimately your responsibility to ensure that it is done and configured. I can tell you that my organization, once a month, I manually check each of our client backups myself, because it is important, because ultimately, if they have a problem, even if it's their problem, they're going to blame me. Okay. So I take personal, and not just me, our company takes personal responsibility and ownership over this process just to ensure our own viability and success. But you should be considering different backup methods. I can tell you, for backup to be considered reliable, it has to be in three different locations. It has to be tested, and it has to be automatic. You know, it should not require the user to manually institute a backup to make it work. So, questions I would ask the provider, you know, how often are these backups tested? Do they work? When's the last time it was tested? Do you have any history of downtime? If so, what did it take to resolve? Where is our backup data located? Ideally, it needs to be in three different locations. You know, you need to have a location with you, a location in two other locations as well. In our case, we use facilities in, as I mentioned, in Oregon, as well as in Ohio. By splitting it in two parts of the country, we've segmented our risk so that one natural big disaster doesn't cripple our organization. Okay. As well as, how is it secured? Is it encrypted? And if it is it encrypted while it's transferring across the network? And is it also encrypted while at rest? All right, colleagues, welcome back to the office. Welcome back to the end of our presentation today. Let's go ahead and have our final review questions, and we will wrap up for the day. Okay, first review question. What security questions should you ask your potential vendor? When was the last time your team or contractor scanned your network to check for vulnerabilities? Well, that sounds pretty good to me, and I would definitely recommend that that is something that you consider asking. What is your procedure for installing updates and patches on our network and workstations? Also, pretty good thing that you would want to ask as well. What is your organization's normal strategy when recommending firewall UTM devices? Yes, those are all really good things that we would want to consider to ask. The correct answer here would be all of the above. Okay, so our next question. How many redundancy tiers are there for data centers? Is it 1, 2, 3, or 4? Well, the correct answer here is 4. There are 4 layers of redundancy with respect to our data centers, with each one representing a different stage of redundancy in terms of what they provide, with level 4 being the highest. As a reminder here, with our level 4, it provides redundancy for internet, power, internal and external, networking, cooling equipment, and more. Ultimately, we're looking for very, very high degree of uptime. Level 4 would be what you would want to strive for, and what you can kind of expect with respect to service providers such as Amazon Web Services, Azure, or more. Alrighty. So our third review question. Which of the following is a business-grade example of business-grade hardware? Is it the Dell Inspiron series? It can be, but not really. It's not 100% what we would consider business-grade. Would it be the Stream devices? No, that would be more for consumer. Would it be Samsung devices? Again, there are parts of it that can be, but the correct answer here would be the ThinkPad. The ThinkPad is your business-grade hardware, with all of those devices always being comparable to what you could expect inside of a business. Alrighty, so today we talked about the different types of redundancy and the different type of characteristics that we can come to expect within data centers, and why you might want to choose one type over the other. We went through and we discussed different types of business grade versus consumer grade hardware. And we also discussed how we would want to select our backup network systems, as well as different network topologies and different strategies for reducing our exposure with respect to how we can improve backup and how we can reduce our risk and exposure by having a good and effective backup solution in place inside of our company. Well, as a reminder, today's webinar is available for CPE credit. If you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, please check out cpetoday.com for all of your continuing education needs. You can earn a credit for watching or listening to today's podcast. It's super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code SRT2. You'll take a brief 5-question quiz, and you will earn a credit for today's class. If you like our material, if you enjoyed our classes and presentation, please consider following us on social media. You can find us on all social media. In most instances, we're at CPE Today. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter. You could subscribe to us on YouTube and more. And you can always catch CPE Today podcast either live or on your schedule. We broadcast live most weeks, twice a week on Tuesdays and Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific. And you can also listen on your own schedule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. We're always striving to bring you the best possible content so that you could be effective in your career and have all the knowledge necessary to be able to utilize technology effectively for your organization. Thank you so much for your time and attention today. It is an absolute pleasure being with you. I look forward to seeing you back in the office the next time around.